Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. First, a review of the COP30 climate talks in Brazil. An interview with Luisa Neubauer, a prominent German activist from Fridays for Future. She describes the various approaches to the climate crisis expressed at the conference and the undermining of reductions in fossil fuels by corporate lobbyists. Germany promised $1 billion for rainforest protection, while it annually gives $60 billion in fossil fuel subsidies. She talks about the importance of continuing the system of climate summits, even if they are broken. Then a report on increasing settler violence in the occupied West Bank, where activists are being targeted. An interview with Aviv Tatarsky, an Israeli researcher with the NGO Amim. He discusses the increased attacks in the occupied West Bank despite the so-called ceasefire and argues that the activities are defined by the term ethnic cleansing. He also discusses annexation, whether by decree or actions. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The COP30 climate talks in Brazil have wrapped up, with delegates reaching a modest agreement in addressing climate change. Nearly 200 countries approved the deal, which includes steps to triple financing for developing countries to cope with extreme weather. But the main COP30 document left out any details about phasing out fossil fuels, something dozens of nations were demanding. The United States was notably absent from the 2-week summit, which saw protests and large street marches. With the first agreement at COP30 leaving out this roadmap for phasing out fossil fuels, I asked Luisa Neubauer from the climate action movement Fridays for Future where that leaves her movement in the fight for climate action.
Well, I think the COP very much brought to life what we all knew. Fossil fuel states and their friends are fighting for their dominance in the world. The most affected states are fighting for their survival. And some of the large industrial nations, including Germany, are fighting with themselves. And that obviously makes it very hard to move forward towards a world without fossil fuels. And it leaves responsibility and leadership with communities of indigenous folks, with frontline communities, with civil societies, and some of those very courageous ministers we saw at COP. And I think our attention really must lie both within the failure of those agreements, but also within that incredible courage and hope that we saw from those front lines, from those voices of change. And we will keep fighting, that is sure. What we see is that the petrostates, their friends, they are fighting with everything they have. That is money, that is disinformation, that is obscene lobbying, 1,600 fossil fuel lobbyists at this COP. And what are Europe, what are Germany doing on the other side? Very half-hearted green speeches, promises that are regularly broken, and the watering down of climate targets. That is not how we can actually live up to what we are seeing out there. That is not how we can actually counterbalance those fossil fuel forces. And that is why I think, obviously, we must point out to those fossil fuel ideologies and fanatics, but we also must point the responsibility to those states who consider themselves to be in for the climate, you know, on track or want to be on track, and also somehow connected to the best available science. And we just do not see that. And that is why I think there's reason to be very disappointed by some of those big democracies who can and must do better. to be very honest, as a EU, to show up at a COP without a real robust climate target for 2040, without having done your homework in time, the deadlines for submitting climate targets was in the beginning of the year. It came a few days before COP. Showing up as countries who have all the money they need, they have the technologies and the political, you know, majorities to actually thrive for climate action, and instead decide to throw taxpayers' money at some of the dirtiest industries, that just doesn't work out. And even while the COP was running in Germany, for instance, the government again decided to provide 350 million euros for the aviation industry in the country as a tax present. I mean, what kind of signal does that send? That's not something we can actually work with. We need countries to be committed in theory, but most importantly, we need them to be committed in practice. And we just, you know, are still looking for that. We saw more than $6 billion US dollars being promised for the rainforest efforts, protection efforts. That is important. Yet to really understand the situation we are in, context is everything. So when we look at a country like Germany, quite a rich industrialized nation, Germany promised after all $1 billion US dollars to provide for efforts to protect the Amazon rainforest and other tropical forests. And at the same time, we are providing $60 billion every single year for fossil fuel subsidies. So obviously those, you know, climate pledges, they do sound good, but at the moment that they're put into context and we understand how much money even some of the most so-called advanced climate nations are still putting into the fossil fuel machinery every year.
Are you still hopeful COP summits can deliver real progress, or is the system broken?
Well, I would say various systems that we operate in are broken, so we must confront that. Regarding the COPs, obviously, they do not live up right now to what is needed. And they fail to protect the science from the disinformation. They fail to protect democratic negotiations from one-sided fossil fuel lobbyism. So obviously, we need to question and challenge how to better equip those COPs and what kind of format is needed to be able to hold space for these crucial and, you know, world-depending negotiations. At the same time, the COPs are one of the very few places where actually all states do meet and where some of the most vulnerable groups in the world are represented and do have access to that. So we must, I guess, acknowledge both sides of that. The fact that we need new initiatives like the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, like the emergence of artivist movements to bring a culture and arts into the negotiation spaces. We must look at indigenous communities much more forcefully and empower them to actually do that incredible protection work that is being happening. And at the same time, we must consider the COPs to be still a place of importance, so they must be protected. We must go there. We must fight for the integrity. And most importantly, I guess, not to expect for climate justice to fall from heaven. That remains hard work that is done by the many. It's not up to these three perfect environmentalists to do us a favor to fix our planetary issues. It's up to millions of very ordinary people who take a step outside their comfort zone and then another one to hold governments accountable and build pressure for actual change.
Luisa Neubauer from Fridays for Future, thank you very much for your time today.
Settler violence in the occupied West Bank continues to escalate. UN figures suggest October has been the worst on record. Israeli settlers recently attacked a Bedouin community and also beat Israeli activists who were present. Israeli citizens trying to protect Palestinians are now becoming targets themselves.
This is an attack on a Bedouin community in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The attackers are the Hilltop Youth, a violent group of Israeli settlers. The footage was filmed by Lisa, a member of Torah Tzedek, a volunteer activist group that documents human rights violations against the Palestinian population in the West Bank. On October 25th, Lisa returned to Haifa with a broken arm and a head injury. Another injured activist was taken to hospital with a liver hemorrhage.
In the past, activists weren't beaten, but I quickly realized that they didn't care who I was. And as I ran past that gate, they hit me from both sides with sticks and stones. I could already feel that my arm was broken. I could feel blood running down my neck. I turned around, you can see that in the video, and saw that the whole community was on fire.
Attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinian villages are a frequent occurrence in the West Bank. The Israeli police and army generally do not prevent the actions of the hilltop youth, even though they describe their actions as illegal. The conflicts mainly take place in what is known as Area C, which is under complete Israeli administrative and military control. This is where large parts of Palestinian agricultural land are located. Pastures for sheep, olive groves, everything the Palestinian population lives on. Israeli settlements are considered illegal under international law. After the attack, only a few men remained to guard what's left of the Bedouin village. The women and children left 6 months ago when the attacks began.
This isn't the first arson attack. There have been two or three in Jabba. They cut off our water supply, came at night, and cut the water pipe. We spoke to the police, to the army. They did nothing, just took photos.
This is Eli Pogrebinsky, a settler who came to Israel from Russia in the early 1990s.
They took the water for their sheep, so we turned off the tap. And we're very happy about that. When I look at this, I see a cancer. The proliferation has become very strong, and the land is not infinitely expandable. These people should do well, but not on my land.
Pope Rybinski does not believe that Jewish youths would beat a defenseless woman, but he says the actions of the hilltop youth are harsh yet effective.
If you say you're against Israeli aggression, people immediately assume you're on Hamas's side, that you're against Israel. But that's not true. These are just people who care about human rights.
After the attack on the activists of October 25th, a resident of the Israeli settlement of Mali Michmas was arrested. 2 weeks later, he was released, and the case was closed.
And let's get more. I am joined now by Aviv Tatarsky. He is a researcher at the Forum for Regional Thinking, an Israeli nonprofit founded that focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Welcome to the program and thank you for your time. Why are these Israeli settlers attacking Israeli activists as well?
The Israeli violence against Palestinian communities, as you described, is reaching extreme heights. Today, when Israeli activists are there in order to prevent this violence, we are attacked as well.
Despite the ceasefire in Gaza, the violence in the occupied West Bank is surging. The Israeli army has even announced a new operation in the northern West Bank. Can you put this a little bit into the broader context for us? What do you make of these moves?
It's not a new phenomenon. It's the Israeli right and the Israeli settler political forces. They, for many years, have targeted or put a goal of ethnic cleansing. There is no other word for it in the West Bank. They didn't have an excuse to carry it out. The Hamas attack on October 7th gave them the perfect excuse. And this is a goal which is stated explicitly by prominent ministers such as Bezalel Smotrich, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and others in the government. When we hear of settlers attacking Palestinian communities, this is just the tip of the iceberg of a very strategic Israeli government decision to destroy the West Bank in a similar fashion to what it did in the Gaza Strip.
And just to be clear, the Israeli government itself would push back on the use of that term that you've just used, ethnic cleansing there.
Maybe I should comment. Israeli ministers have stated explicitly the goal, wipe out Palestinian villages, Palestinian towns in the West Bank. If they don't want to call it ethnic cleansing, it's okay, but they have said it explicitly.
U.S. President Donald Trump has been quite explicit with the current Israeli government, saying that that at least from the U.S. perspective, that they would not accept any annexation of the occupied West Bank. Do you think that the current Israeli government might move ahead with that? Are those calls falling on deaf ears?
You know, annexation has all kinds of dimensions, levels. There's the formal declaration of annexation. And right now, the Trump administration is not allowing Israel to go ahead with it. But expansion of settlements basically creates an annexation reality. And those attacks on Palestinian communities that push them out and that prevent any ability of a decent life, it doesn't matter for Palestinians if it's called annexation or not called annexation. And the international community, just like the Israeli police, is not holding the settler attackers accountable, the international community is not holding Israel accountable. And just playing with this term, well, it's not annexed, that's far from being enough, because the situation in the West Bank is terrible.
Aviv Tatarsky, thank you very much for joining us to share your views on the situation, as we've mentioned there in the occupied West Bank. We appreciate your time.
Those reports and interviews were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, and most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. An update on the conflict enabled by the new Japanese prime minister, who had remarked on a response that a Chinese attack on Taiwan would create in Japan. Chinese President Xi spoke by phone with Trump on the Taiwan issue. Record-breaking rains in Vietnam are still causing flooding, and further rains in Thailand just broke 300-year-old records, leaving many parts underwater. NHK Japan.
Hardly adequate. That's the term China has used in response to the Japanese government's statement related to Prime Minister Takaichi Sanae's recent remark about Taiwan. The statement continues to repeat that Japan's position on Taiwan is either consistent or unchanged. That is hardly adequate. On Tuesday, Japan's cabinet decided on a written reply to a question from an opposition lawmaker on Takaichi's remark over a possible Taiwan emergency. The reply says her administration maintains there is no change to its position on what constitutes a survival-threatening situation for the country. Amid the cooling bilateral relations, the Chinese embassy in Tokyo on Wednesday reiterated a call by Beijing urging Chinese nationals to refrain from traveling to Japan. The embassy posted on social media that reports of discriminatory incidents against Chinese nationals have surged since July this year. It said there has been a marked increase in November. It added there have been recent reports of Chinese citizens suffering verbal abuse and physical assault. The Japanese government denies this. It says the announcement by Beijing suggesting that Chinese nationals in Japan have been at higher risk is not the case.
Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. President Donald Trump have spoken by phone. Beijing's foreign ministry says Xi stressed his country's firm stance on the Taiwan issue. The ministry says on Monday, Xi outlined China's principled position on Taiwan. It adds he told Trump that Taiwan's return to China is an integral part of the post-war international order. It says China and the U.S. fought shoulder to shoulder against fascism and militarism, and it's important for them to jointly safeguard the victory of World War II. The ministry says Trump says the U.S. understands the Taiwan issue's importance to China. Trump posted on social media after the call. He says they discussed various issues, including Ukraine and Russia, fentanyl, and farm products, but did not specifically mention whether Taiwan came up. He says they will visit each other's countries next year.
Torrential rains have been pummeling central Vietnam since last weekend, causing severe flooding and landslides. The government says at least 43 people have died and 9 are missing. It says more than 60,000 houses have been inundated. Damage to fields and rice paddies is widespread, and tens of thousands of livestock and chickens have been killed or swept away. Vietnam has been repeatedly hit by storms and heavy rains this year. The government says natural disasters have left 300 people dead and missing since January. It estimates the damage comes to at least $2.6 billion.
People in southern Thailand are struggling with widespread flooding following several days of record rains. Authorities say at least 33 people have died, with more than 2.5 million affected. Roads and buildings in the southern provinces, including Songkhla and Nakhon Si Thammarat, have been inundated with water. Many people have been trapped in their houses and are being rescued by boats. Weather authorities warned of more rain and are urging people to stay alert for flash floods and landslides. The monsoon rains have also flooded areas in neighboring Malaysia. Disaster management officials say more than 24,000 people, many in the northern states, have been forced to flee their homes. Experts in both countries point to climate change as a driver behind the increased severity and frequency of extreme weather-related disasters.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They are heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK may be easily found at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, like subscribers in Mendocino and Boonville, California did this week, along with a supporter in Utrecht, Netherlands, PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. I am truly grateful for the donations, which are essential for the weekly production and distribution of this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations around the world. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. The Venezuelan government says Mario Rubio is lying about President Maduro being part of a terrorist organization. The G20 summit in South Africa saw leaders adopt a joint declaration addressing the climate crisis without U.S. input, and next year's summit will be in the U.S. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Venezuela has categorically, firmly, and absolutely rejected what it called a new and ridiculous lie by the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who designated the non-existent Cartel de los Soles as a terrorist organization. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs stressed in a press release from Caracas that with this step, the United States is repeating an infamous and vile lie to justify an illegitimate and illegal intervention against Venezuela under the classic U.S. format of regime change. It emphasized its new maneuver will follow the same fate as previous and recurring aggressions against our country. Failure. The official statement emphasized that it is foolish for the Venezuelan government to waste valuable time governing by having to respond to these slanders and calamities. Fortunately, the statement said, the Venezuelan people are more united and cohesive than ever, attending to national life in all of its dimensions and enjoying the Christmas festivities. The text by the Foreign Ministry of Venezuela urged the United States government to rectify this erratic policy of aggression and threats, which have been vehemently rejected by the U.S. people themselves. These actions hinder the development of Caribbean nations and contribute nothing to the genuine fight against illicit drug trafficking. Once again, our people, in perfect popular, police, and military unity, will safeguard peace and the highest interests of our republic. And with the liberator Simón Bolívar, we say aloud, "Peace will be my haven, my glory, and my reward, my hope and my joy." And that is all that is precious to me in the world. The United States' top military officer has visited Puerto Rico as a U.S. Navy warship dispatches to the Caribbean. The visit by General Dan Kane, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, comes as the Donald Trump administration formally designates Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his government allies as members of a foreign terrorist organization, the Cartel de los Soles. The entity is not actually a cartel, and is instead a reference to military officers and officials allegedly involved in corruption and other illegal activities in Venezuela. Reuters is reporting that the United States is also considering a new phase of covert operations in Venezuela. This would be a major escalation after U.S. airstrikes on alleged drug boats in recent weeks have killed more than 80 people without any evidence that the boats were carrying drugs. Meanwhile, six airlines have canceled their flights to Venezuela after the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, warned of a worsening security situation and heightened military activity in the region and warned commercial flights from the United States not to fly over Venezuelan airspace. The G20 summit in South Africa has concluded. It was the first time that the event was held on the African continent. The United States boycotted the meeting, citing false allegations that South Africa was mistreating its white minority Afrikaners. Leaders gathered at the summit adopted a joint declaration to address the climate crisis and other global challenges without input from the United States, which is just as well. The White House claimed that South Africa had weaponized their G20 presidency to undermine the G20's founding principles. Meanwhile, Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has declared the G20 summit in South Africa a success. Lula said, "President Trump has been demonstrating this for several months now. He has already withdrawn from UNESCO and the World Trade Organization. He is attempting to preach the end of militarization in practice, trying to strengthen unilateralism. I believe multilateralism will prevail." Next year's G20 summit will be held in the United States.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report's been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, so I'm staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.